Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Before Surgeon General David Satcher left office last month, he warned Americans not about the dangers of smoking cigarettes, but of the dangers associated with overeating. Obesity, he said, may soon be the number one cause of preventable death in the country. This hour, Americans without question are getting fatter. Are we being sold into obesity by the huge marketing machinery of the American food industry? We begin the hour with the latest on the escalating violence in the Middle East. A Palestinian sniper killed 10 people at an Israeli military checkpoint in the West Bank earlier today. Lee Hockstetter is a reporter with the Washington Post in Jerusalem. I asked him where the weekend's death toll stands and the reasons behind this sharply increasing violence.
There's been a remarkable number of casualties over the last couple of weeks, and although I may have lost track, given the dizzying pace of violence here, I think that if you take in the last 15 or 16 days, there have been something like 110, maybe up to 120 people killed. I can't remember. In fact, I know for a fact that there's not been a similar fortnight like that since the outset of this armed insurrection by the Palestinians, which started in September 2000.
What's going on? Why the intensification? And what, if anything, distinguishes these attacks from previous attacks?
Well, if you look back to the beginning of the Intifada 17 months ago, you see a pattern. You could even graph it. There are a series of gradually escalating spikes once every couple of months, usually, and each one always manages to be somehow worse than the last. And that's what's happening now. It's a cyclical process, and there's very much of a tit-for-tat aspect to it. Each side is absolutely convinced that it is retaliating for the other side's acts of violence against its own civilians and soldiers. And each side becomes convinced that the other side understands only force and only violence and has to be subjected to more of that.
The recent attacks by a Palestinian militia focused on army checkpoints. Of course, most of those are manned by reservists, and it was mostly reservists, I guess, who were killed over the weekend. Has there been an effect on morale within the Israeli army?
In general, Israel has not lost its will to fight, and neither have the Palestinians. There's still plenty of fight left in both of these sides. And although there is a statement going around by army reservists, officers and soldiers, who have signed a statement saying that they will not any longer fight in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, this has been signed by about 300 men. This is a large amount historically in Israel, but it's still somewhat on the fringe. In the main, most Israelis and most Israeli reservists think that it's important to maintain a strong front, and you're even getting this from the left-wing peacenik parties. So although 300 people say they won't fight any longer in the occupied territories, that's still sort of at the fringe of the Israeli body politic.
There have been calls from the ultra-Orthodox wing of Prime Minister Sharon's core constituency for even tougher action. Is there support for that among the broader Israeli public?
Well, the calls aren't only from the ultra-Orthodox religious parts of his government. They're from the entire right-wing part of his government. In fact, they're from his own Likud party. And this has been going on for some months now, that there's a large strain of public opinion in Israel that believes that the only thing that will work at this point is concerted military action that will wipe out the infrastructure of terror, whatever that may mean, and will also topple the Palestinian Authority, which is run by Yasser Arafat. So there is a pretty broad strain of opinion like that. Sharon is walking a tightrope. He has that on his right, people calling for him to really step up the pressure militarily against the Palestinians. But on his left, and also within his coalition government, he has the Labor Party of Shimon Peres, who are urging him to get back to negotiations, in some cases, even if the violence is ongoing. And Sharon is doing neither. He's neither negotiating nor increasing the military pressure to the extent that the right wing would like. So he's trying to steer a middle course. Obviously, it's not working.
Is it possible to, as you say, wipe out the infrastructure of terror without creating a humanitarian nightmare?
Frankly, this phrase, to wipe out the infrastructure of terror, which is used a lot, especially by hardliners in Israel, I think it's a slogan. I'm not sure what it means, and I'm not sure that it's militarily achievable without, as you suggest, the imposition of, if not thousands, certainly many, many hundreds of civilian casualties on the Palestinian side. There are terrorists among the Palestinians, and they tend to be living in the neighborhoods where the Palestinians live. To go out and wipe them out would imply the wiping out of an enormous number of men, women, and children, and it's simply not feasible.
But it does seem to be the operating strategy at the moment, to take away the infrastructure. If it won't work, then what's going on here?
I don't think it's a strategy. I think it's a slogan. And I don't think the Israelis have tried to do anything of the sort.
But if I could interject, Lee, haven't they been going after tunnels that are bringing weapons in, taking out houses of people who they consider to be part of this infrastructure, taking out people who have been identified as leaders in the movement? These are not random acts by the Israelis. They've targeted the infrastructure of terrorism, if you will, haven't they?
Well, look, last week they went into a couple of refugee camps, and today they went into another one. There are dozens and dozens of refugee camps throughout the West Bank and Gaza. In Gaza, there's a refugee camp called Jabalia that has 100,000 people, and I doubt you're going to see the Israeli army traipsing in there any one of these days. As for the tunnels, sure, every once in a while they try to interdict the arms flow through the tunnels that come in from Gaza. But wiping out three or four tunnels may put a slight dent into the arms flow, but frankly, the Palestinians are not having a hard time getting their hands on arms. The Palestinian militant groups and the Palestinian national movement has an enormous number of resources and an enormous will to fight, an enormous will to overthrow the Israeli occupation. And the kind of military action that the Israelis have taken, going into a refugee camp for two or three days here and there, this is not exactly tantamount to wiping out the infrastructure of terror.
And then if the infrastructure cannot be taken away at any reasonable cost, then what is the operating strategy here?
Most Israelis don't believe that Ariel Sharon has an operating strategy. Polls have shown this overwhelmingly. Even within Sharon's own party, it's easy to hear critics saying publicly that Ariel Sharon has no strategy. And by the way, the same is said by Palestinians about Yasser Arafat. You're looking at two leaders, both well into their 70s, two old men who have been fighting each other for many, many years, neither of whom has really joined the modern age. Neither of these men, for example, has ever used a computer or looked at one. They are without a strategy. The strategy I think that the two of them understand is that if they inflict enough pain on the other side, perhaps the other side will cry uncle. But unfortunately, that strategy, if you can call it a strategy, is not working. It's not working for the Palestinians, and it's not working for the Israelis.
Lee Hockstetter is a reporter with The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from Jerusalem. Shifting gears, is a Twinkie or a ho-ho as insidious as a cigarette? It may sound absurd, but in her new book, Food Politics, Marion Nestle argues that the primary motivations of the food and tobacco industries are the same. Build appetites, cement habits, boost consumption, and sell products. The food companies, she says, only care about nutrition when it helps sales, and the eat less message of nutritionists directly conflicts with the industry's agenda to get consumers to eat more. What do you think about the American food industry? Is it selling obesity? Is it raking in a profit at the expense of the country's health? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from New York is Marion Nestle. She's chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food Studies at New York University and author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Good evening and welcome, Marion Nestle.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Marion Nestle, make your case for us. I guess most of us go about the business of shopping and eating one food at a time. We don't often think of the food industry as a monolith, wooing us, selling us to become obese and through that unhealthy. Is that, in fact, what's going on in the United States?
Well, of course, it's not a monolith. It's an industry like any other with many, many individual food products. But each individual food product isn't a problem in itself. It's the aggregate that's a problem. And it's the idea of selling enormous amounts of food to enormous numbers of people that is encouraging people to eat more. The industry is in many ways, the marketing part of the industry is similar to cigarettes. Obviously, foods don't kill people in the same way. But overall, diseases related to overeating amount to just as many illnesses and deaths as cigarettes in the aggregate. But what makes it so complicated is that when you're talking about individual products, it just doesn't seem like that. And no individual product is at fault, but the industry as a whole has a problem.
So we'll get to how the industry sells all that food that we all eat. But what are the consequences? What's happening to American waistlines, and what are the health consequences of what we know is an increase? How big is it, and what does it mean for us?
Well, it's enormous, and the astounding part about it is that it's all happened within the last 15 years, so that we can't blame it on genetics. We have to blame it on some kind of behavior, and there are two sides to the obesity equation, eating more and moving less, and both are happening. But I think the eating side is the one that's most obvious and actually is better documented. People are eating more, and we see it in larger portions. We see it in larger waistlines, and we see it in rising rates of what used to be adult onset diabetes in very young children.
We heard from U.S. Surgeon General David Satcher just late last year saying that overeating, obesity, could soon cause as much preventable disease and death as cigarette smoking. That's kind of a shocking way of looking at it. He said that 300,000 Americans die each year from health problems related to obesity, that it's a condition that he says should be treated as a disease. He says obesity costs the United States $117 billion a year. This is no laughing matter. This sounds like a real public health problem.
Well, it is a real public health problem, and it's the leading public health nutrition problem in the country today. And where it's especially a problem is in children. Children never used to have very much what we call adult onset or type 2 diabetes. And now we're seeing it in children as young as 6 or 7 and 8. It's really quite shocking. It's a terrible disease. And it's preventable for the most part by adjusting caloric intake and caloric expenditure, or the amount you eat and the amount of exercise that you get.
So Americans, we know, do walk around with a burden of guilt that's as big as the weight they carry, thinking, I should exercise more, I should eat better. But you are interestingly making the case that our entire sense of what's appropriate food consumption is being constantly shaped by this massive marketing expenditure of the food industry at large.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody sees this. It's almost invisible. But they spend, food companies in aggregate spend about $30 billion a year in encouraging people to eat more of their products. And they do that through advertising, but also through different kinds of marketing techniques like games and product placements and soft drink contracts in schools and T-shirts and toys, and also in other ways that are less obvious, like larger portions and new products and marketing foods as nutritious because vitamins are added or herbs are added. And then there's all the really behind-the-scenes kind of thing, which is the extensive lobbying of food companies, of government, to make sure that there are no unfavorable regulations or unfavorable legislation that might get people to eat less of their products. And then, of course, dealing with food and nutrition professionals to make sure that nutritionists don't say anything that might indicate that people should eat less of one or another product. All of those.
Mary Nissel, the way you describe it, it sounds almost like a conspiracy to create the Fatso Nation.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. It's just good business practice. It's the way we do business in this country. Think of Enron. That's business practice. I don't think that food companies are deliberately setting out to make people fat. They're deliberately setting out to sell food. That's their job.
Well, but that's is that like saying tobacco companies were not deliberately setting out to give people cancer? They were setting out to give people a little break in the middle of the day.
Well, I think there are some similarities there, but I don't feel the same way about any particular food product that I do about cigarettes. I think it's a much more complicated problem, but one that I would hope that people would begin to recognize and realize that when an enormous plate of food is being set in front of them, there's a reason for it. It isn't necessarily to make them fat. It's to make them spend more money.
How does American food intake compare today with 20, 30 years ago?
Well, there's certainly more calories. 30 years ago, the average, the food supply provides an average of 3,800 calories for every man, woman, and child in the country right now, even babies. And that's more than twice as much as most women need and about a third as much as more men, as men need, and lots more than babies need.
But we're putting it somewhere.
We're putting it somewhere. Some of it is being wasted, but an awful lot of it is being eaten. And it's 500 calories a day more than 30 years ago. And the research evidence on what people are eating suggests that people are eating more calories than they did 30 years ago on average.
Mary Nestle, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Mary Nestle is author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Is the food industry selling obesity? Should we have cigarette-style health warnings on Twinkies? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the notion that the American food industry may, in fact, deliberately or just through its cumulative marketing efforts, be selling obesity to Americans. The U.S. Surgeon General said late last year that obesity will soon cause as much preventable disease and death as cigarette smoking, that 300,000 Americans die each year from health problems directly related to obesity, and it's moving down to the level of children. What do you think? Should we have cigarette-style health warnings on Twinkies? Should junk food marketing be regulated? Are food companies making fat junkies out of American children? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Marion Nestle. She's author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Marion Nestle, you said before the break, and fairly, that this is not a conspiracy, but your book is very tough. Make your toughest case for us on how the food industry contributes to American obesity.
I would say food marketing in schools is the place where it's most egregious. There are soft drink companies that have exclusive contracts with school districts to market their products, and part of the marketing is a bonus for schools that exceed their target sales, so that it essentially puts the schools in the position of pushing soft drinks. Now, an occasional soft drink is not a problem, but soft drinks are mainly sugar and water, and if kids are sipping them all day long, then those calories are going to replace more nutritious calories, interfere with school lunches, and do all kinds of other things.
So the soda pop in the schools, what else are food manufacturers doing to encourage children to gobble up their processed foods?
Well, there's an enormous effort to market in schools. There's this Channel 1 television program that has 2 minutes of required commercials that children must watch as part of the programming. Food companies provide teaching materials to schools with logos on it, and it starts at an extremely young age. There are counting books for cookies or sugar-coated breakfast cereals where kids learn to count by putting the cereal in the book, and these are for toddlers.
You've written M&M's toys, McDonald's toys, clothing that has food icons on it. Does all this contribute to a warped sense of what an appropriate diet is for children?
Well, it certainly contributes to brand loyalty at an astonishingly early age. And what's amazing about it to me is that this is the one place where the marketing is absolutely deliberate. And food marketers will say, we are targeting this food and this message to 7- and 8-year-old children. Or we're going to market it to 4-year-old boys. Deliberate strategy to try to encourage brand loyalty in children at very, very young ages. And the rationale for it, of course, is that this is a matter of choice, and that if they can establish preferences in early ages, children control an enormous amount of not only their own purchasing ability, but also the influence of their caretakers and parents' purchasing ability.
This is brand loyalty. That's to brands that are often. This is not broccoli we're talking about here.
High fat, high salt,
high sugar foods. Very often,
we're talking about what nutritionists tend to call as junk foods. Although that's not a very precise term, but if you look at the Department of Agriculture guidelines and the pyramid. The pyramid is hierarchical. These are foods from the top of the pyramid that are supposed to be consumed in very small amounts, and it's where most of the advertising and marketing dollars go.
Mary Nissel, stand by. I want to turn now to Lisa Caddick. She's Director of Scientific and Nutrition Policy with the Grocery Manufacturers of America. It's a trade organization that represents the major food and beverage manufacturers. Good evening and welcome, Lisa Caddick. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. It's a pleasure.
Lisa Caddick, the food industry is getting a working over here tonight, compared at least from a distance with the tobacco industry, with cigarette manufacturers. I guess that, you know, one by one, Twinkies and Ho-Hos are funny and fun, but cumulatively, we've got a public health crisis in the United States, the Surgeon General says, that has to do with obesity. How do food manufacturers square their desire to sell more Twinkies with every citizen's desire to live in a healthy country?
Well, I think, first of all, I want to start out by saying that pointing the fingers and laying blame on the food industry will no doubt sell books, but it certainly will do nothing to help prevent this problem. And we definitely do have a problem.
Well, that's easy to say, but if you're marketing Fruit Loops, if you're marketing Fruit Loops, you're marketing Fruit Loops.
Well, I think that we really have to look at this in a broad context. You know, we're being blamed for advertising and spending billions of dollars on advertising, when I think what's not brought out is that those dollars of advertising include everything, including grains and fruits and vegetables and low-fat foods and yogurts and waters and juices, all of those things that are included in that nutrition pyramid.
If I'm not mistaken, and Mary Nissel, speak to me on this, but it's $30 billion overall. I think I saw the number $2 million for vegetable marketing.
Well, we just learned of an...
No, that's government spending.
Government, mm-hmm. Sorry, Lisa.
Today there was a report that came out that stated that Chiquita is launching, and you've probably already seen some of this, a massive ad campaign to advertise fresh fruits, including bananas, cantaloupes, and grapes.
But Lisa Caddick, I mean, the case that most of these marketing dollars go to unprocessed fruits and vegetables, are you? I mean, honestly?
No, we market products that consumers want, and that includes products in every food category that's available to consumers.
Is the position of the food industry that they will sell whatever Americans want to buy, and if people eat too much of it, that's their own problem? Thank you very much.
Well, I don't think that we would put it in those same words. We certainly agree and feel that there is... and consumers would agree as well, that there is a certain amount of personal responsibility that's involved in making healthy food choices. I can't imagine that the food industry is going to be able to mandate the choices that people make, nor would government be able to do that. I think the government has two very important roles, and that's certainly to protect the health and safety of consumers, but also to educate the public about proper nutrition and balance of physical activity. And it's a lot of the activity message that's really been pretty much taken out of our lives. And we talked about schools earlier. There's a serious crisis in schools right now, where there's virtually no physical education that's being conducted in schools today. And there's been a major thrust. We've
all seen that. We know that problem.
Well, I think a lot of people don't. I mean, we've done some research and found that parents think that their children are very active in school and still involved in PE, and in fact, you know, that's not the case.
Lisa Caddick, stand by. I want to put it to Marion Nissel. Marion, Lisa Caddick makes the case that, look, they're just making what Americans want, and if they buy it, they should be free to buy it and move around more to deal with the calories. Do you think that the food industry is as innocent as all that?
Well, first of all, let me say hello to Lisa. We know each other. Hi, Lisa. I think she's raising two very, very important points, one of which is personal choice and responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that food choices are a matter of personal choice and responsibility. But I think consumers need more information about what's going on. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is that much of food industry marketing is invisible to the general public.
What do you mean by that, Marion Nissel?
Well, a lot of it is taking place at the government level, where companies think Enron. They're doing the same kinds of things that Enron did. They're dealing with their congressmen. They're dealing with Congress.
To accomplish what? Enron makes me think of oil.
To create a favorable regulatory environment, to make sure that dietary guidelines are ambiguous and euphemistic.
For example?
To make Diet. Well, I guess the best example is the dietary guideline for sugar in the last dietary guidelines for Americans. The word limit was removed by the department. Limit your intake of sugar was of added sugar was removed by the Department of Agriculture under pressure from sugar lobbying organizations, and that was pretty well documented by the press. And that may not seem like a very important thing, but it means that the government is not giving very clear messages about what a healthful diet is, and consumers are enormously confused about it. And then the other point is activity is exceedingly important, and it's much easier to overeat calories if you're also overexpending calories, but it's always interesting to me to see how it's so easy to shift the attention to the activity side of the equation because nobody wants to talk about the need to eat less.
Well, and of course,
it's much more controversial to talk about eating less than it is to talk about moving more.
But of course, the profit margins on heavily processed foods are simply higher. And I wonder, is it possible? I mean, on the one hand, it sounds absurd. Everyone should be sensible about what they eat. It's everyone's personal responsibility. But if we're surrounded by a world of food that's high fat, high salt, high sugar, and that's marketed to us constantly, does it warp our fundamental instincts toward those that greed for sugar, salt, and fat, Lisa Kadic? Is it possible that we set up a kind of appetite through our marketing and through the kinds of foods on the shelves that leads to what we've seen so starkly described by the Surgeon General as an epidemic of obesity?
I really think that we've seen a total influx of products that meet consumers' needs. You know, that are low in fat, low in sugar, low in sodium, low in caffeine. I mean, we pretty much provide, or caffeine-free, something for everybody.
And yet, Americans, 61% of adults are overweight, 14% of adolescents, 12% of youngsters. You've got doubling of obesity rates among black children and something like that among Hispanics.
Those rates are staggering. I agree that we have a problem. I disagree where you're saying that's coming from. I want to go back to the point about that was talked about as far as influencing policy. I think that it's no secret. You know, we live in a democracy here. It's no secret that everybody talks to government, members of Congress and federal regulators. You know, it's our basic right. And we do that just as consumer groups do that. Public health officials like physicians and dietitians do that. I think what's really important, back to the example given about the dietary guidelines, is our message is really quite simple. We want to base things on science. And that was part of the debate about that issue, was that it was not based in science. It was about politics and emotion.
Which issue is that? Is that the 300,000 dying annually?
The sugar guideline.
Oh, I see.
The sugar guideline. I mean, that's what we have to go on. That's all that we can affect. And if the science doesn't fall in our direction, then so be it. But if certainly the science is in a certain direction and regulators are moving in the opposite direction, there's no doubt that the industry is going to get in there and talk to them about where the science
is. We imagine they will. Lisa Kadic, Mary Nestle, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much. I wonder if I could draw a parallel between the food industry and the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay.
And that is that the pharmaceutical industry is well known for lobbying with the medical profession to advocate the use of certain drugs and so forth. And I wonder whether, too, the food industry gets involved, and this is a question for the first guest, in advocating with doctors about the health benefits of foods or whatever. I mean, I had an experience, and father of a small child, a few years ago, speaking with the pediatrician about some of the eating habits, and the pediatrician's response was this sort of offhand, well, if the child's thriving, it doesn't really matter if all she's eating is pasta. You know, that my son just eats peanut butter sandwiches all day long and he's fine. And I contrast that with my own experience a generation ago, you know, where eat your vegetables was the sort of age-old chime.
We all heard it. Chris, thanks for that. Let me put it to Marion Nestle. Marion Nestle, are parents giving the right kind of guidance to their children, and is the medical community giving clear enough guidance to parents?
Well, I'd rather talk about our nutritionists giving clear enough advice.
Fair enough.
If that's okay, because I think the parallel is absolutely there. And one of the things that I do in this book is I have a whole chapter devoted to how food companies influence food and nutrition professionals. And I think the parallels with drug companies are very clear.
Lay them out for us.
food companies sponsor research, and that research amazingly comes out favorable to the company's products. It's quite coincidental. They sponsor annual meetings of nutrition organizations. They sponsor journals. They pay travel. They do all kinds of things that encourage nutritionists.
And Mary, you've accepted some of that money.
And I have accepted some of it, and I reveal it thoroughly in every chance I get.
So are you saying we're not getting an accurate picture of what's nutrition and what's not?
I think it's very, very difficult to find nutritionists with independent positions. It's difficult for government to find nutrition professionals to come into committees who are independent of food company sponsorship. And it's difficult for nutritionists because the idea that if you're going to help people change their diets, you must work with the food industry is one that a lot of people have bought into. And it's kind of led into what has become sort of a nutritionist's mantra, which is there is no such thing as a good or a bad food. All foods are part of a healthful diet.
Well,
whereas
in moderation.
And you hear people say this all the time, whereas in fact some foods are better to eat than others and some diets are better than others.
Mm-hmm. Mary Nissel, stand by. I want to get another caller in. Steve's calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to preface my comments with a couple of pieces of information about myself.
Please.
I am 50 years old. I'm 6 feet tall, 175 pounds.
Way to go, Steve.
Thank you. I'm on a low-fat diet. I used to eat junk food mercilessly. I also have a 16-year-old daughter that is built similarly to me. In fact, she's quite thin. I think I have a problem with this whole debate because I think that this is one of the more outrageous forms of the nanny state that I have seen. By the way, I'm also a businessman, and I want to make a point that your author made. I have a problem with the parallel draw to Enron. Enron is not good business. It's not normal business. It's bad business.
It's criminal, perhaps, or corrupt in
a way. Yeah, it's not what most business people would do, and it's not an example of how business, the normal way that business operates.
We got that, Steve, but your nanny state comment is
right.
Saying that there's no role here for government oversight or regulation of food.
I'm not saying that. I think that what's happening is that the food industry is being blamed for individual choices that people have to make. And I don't think the government can regulate those choices by regulating an industry.
But, Steve, is it possible that parents, let's say, trying to advise their children or even their own appetites are overwhelmed by a $30 billion marketing campaign? You're a business person. You know how powerful that can be.
Well, I think parents are overwhelmed by a lot of forces these days, both in business and social forces.
Mm-hmm.
But I think parents have a responsibility. For example, the thing about schools are made up of school boards, which are elected. There are open meetings. There are PTAs. If a school board or a group of parents do not want a soft drink industry in that school, they have the ability in a democracy to change that.
Steve, we thank you for your call. We got your point. If you don't like the food, if you don't like the soda pop in your school, stand up and kick it out. And thanks very much for calling in. Lisa Caddick, is that your view, that people should simply take control of their own diets, their own schools, their own food environments?
Well, absolutely. We think that if this problem is really going to be addressed on, a proactive and positive way, it's going to require the coming together of many different forces. So I don't want to say that, the industry doesn't have a role to play. We definitely do. And we actually have been working tirelessly for a long, long time to try to increase nutrition education in schools and in communities and support and fund physical activity programs at the community level and in schools.
Mm.
So, yes, we're saying it's personal responsibility. However, we're on board, too, and we're here to put our resources toward programs that we know are effective and are going to work for consumers.
On board, in a big way, the largest increase in size of portions, I guess I'm looking at a factoid here, 700% increase in the size of the average American cookie. Things are getting big, folks. Can parents effectively hold a line against $30 billion in food marketing? Are you eating more than you used to? Do you know why? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about American obesity. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The U.S. Surgeon General says we have an epidemic of obesity in America, that it's out of control and will soon be more dangerous than cigarette smoking. Part of the problem may be traced back, a new book says, to the $30 billion that the U.S. food industry spends on marketing foods, from Fruit Loops to Twinkies to steaks and broccoli. Our guest tonight, Marion Nestle, is author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. We're also joined by Lisa Caddick. She's Director of Scientific and Nutrition Policy with the Grocery Manufacturers of America. And the question is food restraint a personal responsibility or a corporate responsibility, a government responsibility? Should we have cigarette-style health warnings on Twinkies? Should Americans be able to sue big food makers for their own big waistlines? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now by John Bansaff. He's professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. He's executive director of Action on Smoking and Health, a nonprofit organization representing non-smokers' rights. Good evening and welcome, John Bansaff.
Good evening.
John, will we see lawsuits filed against the food industry like we saw filed against the tobacco industry one day?
We already have. They're good. They're doing very well. And let me explain that one of the things which hasn't come out so far is that this is an epidemic and a problem because it costs the American public about $115 billion a year, according to the Surgeon General. And just like with smoking, most of that cost is borne by the people who have good health habits.
How does it cost the country that much money, John Bansaff?
Say again, please.
How does it cost that much money?
Primarily in health care costs, but also in time lost from work and other ways. And people who maintain healthy weight and don't smoke pay more for taxes because under Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, and so on, people who smoke or are obese have far higher health costs because most health insurance companies charge people the same whether they practice healthy or non-healthy habits. They pay more there.
But is the food industry really a target like the big tobacco manufacturers?
Well, they are with several lawsuits which are in effect and which are being planned. Mm-hmm. But before we go to lawsuits, let me simply mention that in terms of individual responsibility and using the same tactics which have been so effective against the tobacco industry, one is simply to tax the product. We tax cigarettes very highly. This reduces the unfairness because the smoker is forced to pay more. It's good education, and some of that money can then be used for anti-smoking education, or in this case, for anti-obesity education.
So it's $5 for a payday candy bar?
I don't know whether it'd be $5, but it might be 15 or 20 cents for a Super Double Whopper cheeseburger. Another is, of course, to have what we call differential health insurance rates. Many health insurance companies are now charging smokers more than non-smokers. Again, it's fairness. Again, it's education. And these are ways to get back at the individual responsibility.
Now, so that if you're heavier, you might pay more for your health insurance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, we go to lawsuits. There are two already in progress. One which I helped to bring was against McDonald's for alleged misrepresentation of their French fries. As a result of that lawsuit, it was certified as a class action. McDonald's has apologized. McDonald's is now providing an adequate disclosure, but they still have to pay damages. Another one is now going on in Florida. It involves alleged misrepresentation of the fat and calorie content of a low-fat, low-calorie ice cream.
So John Bansaff, will these be consequential enough that they might change the food on the shelves of American grocery supermarkets?
Well, the first step is we simply get them to fairly disclose what is in the product and not to make omissions. So, for example, one could go after the people who advertise milk, the Milk Mustache campaign, for not, for example, telling people that you can get the same health benefits from skim milk. Mm. You could go after the people who advertise pork as the other white meat, which really is a little bit deceptive because it suggests that it's more like chicken than it is like beef, and it isn't. And finally, one could go after fast food manufacturers who a recent National Academy of Sciences study said are one of the major problems we have now with obesity, not just here, but around the world, to require them to make adequate disclosures. So if I walk into a food store, I know what the calorie content and the food content is in terms not just of grams, but of percentages. But when I watch an ad on television for a Super Double Whopper burger, I'm not told that that's twice my daily calorie allowance.
Might be there, too. John Bansaff, you paint a world that is an entirely new, kind of an amazing notion of all this being potentially regulated and suits coming up. But when we see the the scale of the problem. Perhaps that's what's coming. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, John.
About tobacco, that's why we're winning using exactly these same tactics.
And we've seen that. John Banzhaf is professor at George Washington University Law School and executive director of Action on Smoking and Health. It's a nonprofit organization representing non-smokers' rights and now looking at food as well. Let's turn to our callers. Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for Marion. It seems to me that Marion seems to be backing off from every opportunity you've given her from taking a really strong position against the food industry. And she did mention that nutritionists, you know, in particular, and the people that research food in this country, you know, are very much beholden to the food industry for funding. And I kind of wonder whether or not she might be one of those people, because...
Well, let me ask you first, Kevin, do you have a special insight on this?
Well, nothing in particular, except that, you know, I mean, I worked in the restaurant business for 20 years, and I know food pretty well, and I know the way people eat, and I know that people will eat basically what they're sold to, and while... I forgot the other woman's name other than Marion.
Lisa Caddick.
She mentioned that people are making choices out there when we had already established the fact that the food industry is advertising to children and marketing to children. Children don't make their own choices. People like Eric Schlosser in Fast Food Nation made an awful lot of fantastic points about what's happening to food, to the food industry in this country, and it doesn't just start with soda machines in schools. It runs all the way to the labor industry and what they've done to turn skilled jobs into unskilled jobs in the food business.
Hmm. Kevin, we hear your perspective, and thanks for your call. Marion Nessel, Kevin says you're not being strong enough describing the...
Let's ask Lisa about that. Lisa, am I being strong enough? I think Lisa would say I'm being far too strong.
Actually, but Go ahead.
I think that what Kevin, you haven't read my book, have you?
Kevin's gone, but he's gone. I guess he's just listening tonight for the first time.
Yeah, I don't think he's read it or...
Are you pulling punches, Marion?
No, I'm trying to be somewhat balanced. I don't think that the food industry is the cigarette industry. They're not equivalent, but their marketing has many parallels. I don't know whether that's hedging or backing off, but it's really what I believe. And it makes it more, in some ways, it's much more complicated than dealing with cigarettes. With cigarettes, you just say, don't smoke, flat out. With food, it's more complicated. People have to eat. People like to eat. Food is wonderful. So then the choices have to be eating less or eating this instead of that. That's a much more complicated message.
But what about John Banzhaf's view that we've gotten into a situation where the choices offered are suable because they're so heavy in fat, they're so heavy in sugars and salts that it's actionable in the court system?
Well, I think that's going to be very interesting to watch. I personally think that I like the idea that people are talking about it, and I like the idea that it's being considered. I think it would be very, very difficult on the tax side to figure out how to go about taxing almost anything except soft drinks. Soft drinks are a really easy target because they're sugar and water and nothing else. And I kind of like the idea of a tiny little tax on soft drinks, so small that nobody would notice, but one that would maybe less than a penny a bottle or can, for example.
Lisa Caddick, last word maybe going to you here. Do you see new taxes and lawsuits coming at the food industry if Americans conclude that they're partly responsible for the obesity of this nation's population?
Well, I want to go back to something that I think is interesting where Mary and I do agree, is that making food choices is a very complex issue, and I think that's something that needs to be brought out and repeated. But to the tax issue, you know, where do we stop, and how is it that the food industry owns the tax issue? I think we can start laying out many areas of our life that contribute to obesity. For instance, things that contribute to physical inactivity, mm-hmm. automobiles, TV watching, computer games, video
games. It's a big list. Lisa, I'm going to have to say goodnight.
So,
we're out of time. Lisa Caddick is Director of Scientific and Nutrition Policy with the Grocery Manufacturers of America. Thanks for being with us tonight, Lisa Caddick.
My pleasure.
And Marion Nessel is author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Marion, thanks for being with us.
A pleasure.
Read Marion Nessel's study, The Contribution of Expanding Portion Sizes to the U.S. Obesity Epidemic, on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. We asked listeners to tell us about the music they've been listening to these days that's brought particular comfort or inspiration or insight into news stories that are touching all of our lives. Tonight, we hear from Bob Fleischer, an engineer living in Groton, Massachusetts. Since September 11th, he's been surprised to find himself pulling out his old Bob Dylan records and surprised to find even more sense in them than he did as a college kid during the Vietnam era.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand?
You know, when I was growing up in the 60s, especially when I was in college in the late 60s, I listened to the popular Dylan, you know, Blowing in the Wind was a favorite of mine, but I didn't really listen to too much of his hard-edged protest music.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Back then, I didn't take part in any protest demonstrations. After Kent State, when everyone else went on strike, I still did my homework and went to whatever classes were still available. Back then, I was an engineering student, and I was pretty much straight nose to the grindstone on my engineering work, and didn't pay that much attention to political things.
It is washed to the sea.
In my early adulthood, after leaving college, after the 60s, early 70s, I probably was sort of lagging a lot of the fellow students who were more radical in the 60s, or at least more liberal and political in the 60s. And, you know, this was the era of Watergate and things like that. And that passed, and it passed in a fairly satisfactory way. You know, Nixon was basically punished. Those crimes were basically put behind. Some people were jailed and stuff like that. It seemed as if the political system and justice system was working, and especially with the history of the 60s, civil rights acts and things like that. So I must admit, you had this feeling of history progressing on a very satisfactory track. So I don't think I would have thought that times like these would come again, or that new times would come that would remind me of those times. But maybe I was naive about that. Some of the more prophetic voices in our history have said that you can't assume that history is a one-way street, that things always get better.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one?
Election 2000 was certainly a big wake-up call for me. It's something that really upset me. And that upset continues to this day, so that in some sense, before 9/11, I was already politically sensitized and aware that isn't going to be an isolated incident. The society is changing in many ways. I certainly couldn't have predicted 9/11, and yet I had that fear even before 9/11 that society is on a bad course right now. I found that since 9/11 that I've been listening to a lot of my older recordings from the sort of the protest era of folk music. Today's events are not exactly the same things that the protest music were protesting against. Yet I still think they're appropriate, because on one level they were protesting Vietnam, which is very different from the war on terrorism. I think the Dylan song that speaks the most to me is With God on Their Side.
Oh, my name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less.
Especially in the current crisis, people who attacked us apparently have attacked us because God told them to. And, of course, a lot of the rhetoric that President Bush has used in encouraging Americans to be strong in this struggle also uses references to God. You know, I really love the ending of that song, where basically Dylan says, if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war.
And fall to the floor. That if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war.
I'm not really a radical. I certainly wasn't a radical by the standards before 9/11. And yet now, because I'm in that 15% that don't particularly support President Bush, I feel a little bit like a radical. I feel a little bit like I'm in a minority, a fairly small minority. And that's actually a scary position to be in. I turn to music that sort of speaks the way I'm thinking and gives me comfort.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
Bob Fleischer lives in Groton, Massachusetts. Listeners, we want to hear your story on our program. Write in and let us know what music you've turned to lately for comfort or inspiration, what albums or songs or symphonies are resonating with you as you read the paper or listen or watch the news. These diaries start with a note from you. Send us an email at onpoint@wbur.org or send us a letter to On Point, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And there's no telling who that it's naming.